Hi everyone, welcome to North and South. Please support any way you can. And we're doing a community politics, kind of literature, all kinds of themes going on today. Podcast with Bobby Brennan, who's been on before. He's a former Labour councillor in the Sefton area. And he's writing a book. So, Bobby, what's the latest with you and why are you writing this book?
Well, I've actually finished the book now, Tim. The idea came from, we have a caravan in Wales, and we picked a book up out of Tesco's in the bookstall, and it was a book by Roger McGough, and it was his autobiography, and it was really, I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. I didn't realise Roger McGough, obviously the poet and the scaffold fade, that he was actually from Lidland. Or in his book, he was talking about all the places that I went to as a child. He mentions things about, like, the Broadway store in beautiful Lidland Gala, Lidland Park and the swings. They're all things that resonated with me, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. But when I deliver training, I deliver a lot of training, you know, for my employer, and deliver a lot of training around mental health, and I worked in the legal profession for many years. Mental health was a main sort of subject for me. And I support a lot of mental health service users, and in talking about mental health, I'm able to give a lot of anecdotal sort of information, and people say you should write a book because there's lots of things. And the book, to be honest, it's a cross between probably Ken Loach's Kes, the American come-of-age film, Stand By Me, because I had the same really upbringing as Casper in Kes. Family was very impoverished. It was gambling in the family. It wasn't a really happy childhood. It was, you know, I was my granddad, my nana, were the ones that really brought me up. I was born in King Avenue in Orrell, and that was the become a council for King Avenue for the Orrell area, and some of the residents in King Avenue were there when I was a child, when I became a councillor. So my granddad and my nana brought me up, and I have happy memories. I don't have happy memories really of my home life, because as I say, it was gambling, and really were quite impoverished. I decided to, you know, write about, you know, those things, because like in the film Kes, I also had a paper round, and I would get the Beano and the Dandy, and I'd sit there and read the comics before I delivered them. Occasionally take out the free gifts. And I've covered a lot of that in the book, some funny, you know, anecdotes where I progress from the Beano and the Dandy to the Victor. And then before I delivered the paper round, my mum would say to me, right, let Mary, my sister, said, let her read the comic. She'd have the Bunty comic, and my mum would say, you know, I'd say, mum, I need to deliver the paper. She said, well, Mary's still reading the comic. And I said, well, it's not Mary's comic, it's you know, it's one of them. And it would be, well, you want to have a paper round if you carry on like this. So I'd be going out knowing that I'd get a few doors away, and someone shouts, hey, where's the Bunty? Or and I'd have to say, oh, it's in the other sack, I'll bring it back. And I went back one time to find the actual, on the back of that comic, they had like cut out dresses for, and my sister cut them all out. So it was a case of, that couldn't be delivered. And of course, that came out of my paper money. So there's little things like that about Kes. And of course, shamefully, I would say now, but obviously then, Baird's egg collecting was a pastime of many, many boys. So same as in Kes, we used to go, like, you know, Baird's egging. And one of the things, I mentioned the book, the Boundary Lane, the field there, it was a haven for skylarks. And you wonder now, you know, there's no skylarks. And you think, when you're stealing skylarks' eggs and destroying nests or robbing eggs years ago, you wonder, you know, the impact that's going to have. And now you wonder why you don't hear skylarks singing over Buell Golf Course and all that. So, it, you know, looking back, but all most boys did it then, I would say. It was just a pastime. So there's all that, all the same as with Kes. And the Stand By Me, I had some really wonderful friends, and it was a little group of friends, and we went on our own little journeys out to, like, from Ford, where I grew up, and to Innsblundell or to Formby. And we'd encounter all sorts of, you know, what are you doing here, and get back. And there was one occasion where we were cycling to Formby, and then we stopped by Lancaster Constabulary by what was then the Innsblundell pub. Are these your bikes? You know, and, well, yeah, they are. You know, where are you from? Like, they're Ford, and this Lancashire Constabulary officer says, where's that? We were, like, taken back because he didn't know where Ford was. It's a Bootley event. I might have known. Then he'd done a check to see who we really were. And it's things like, and it was like, you know, don't let me see you around here again. No, we'd been on a cycle journey, someone else to Formby, to find newts and that, which we released back into the ponds. And the things like that, and we go to, like, what was the old Crosby Baths. I remember one occasion I was picking up, there was a derelict house, and there was all daffodils in the garden, so it was around Easter time. So I picked this big bunch of daffodils to take on to my mum, so it was on the platform. Where'd you get them from? You stole them, haven't you? Sick of you people coming here stealing things and all that. This is all you ever do. I said, no, we're from Derek's house. So, again, took off, the daffodils are took off me, and then don't let me see you around here again, and you feel the boot of my, you feel my boot on your backside. And that's how things were. It was like, it was like a discrimination against people from, you know, from Bootle. And so we had really great friends who were stuck with for many years, and we get on, you know, we did all sorts of funny things. Like, there's a lot of humour in it, and of course, I've kept in a lot of expletives because it's been true to the characters, because I had some incredible friends who were like, some of them were bonkers. And there's a book by, there's an author called Sven Hassel, who writes old German books about his experience during with the Wehrmacht during the Second World War. And my friends, I can relate to them, because one of my friends is very much like Tiny. It was the hamburger Wehrmacht soldier. And my friends, I can relate to him because he was scared of nothing, but he was always getting into scrapes. So there's things where, yeah, you know, and again, the late 60s, early 70s, when I was growing up, you saw then the rise in football violence. You had, like, skinheads were coming through, so you had, the Bother Boys that they were known in London. And
the Bother Boots, they were named after them, weren't they?
And you know, you go to the away games and some... You know, experiences travelling to watch Liverpool away, including going to Man United, and that was I went there just the one and only time I wouldn't go there again after what happened. It was shocking, and I refer to it in the book, and the stewards in Manchester in the ground did nothing to protect us. It was a horrible situation. And then I again, you know, you look at gang culture, and every estate had a gang, and we went. It was the way it was then, and I had a Lambretta scooter. I was a mod. So my friends were, and, you know, and I covered all things like that, and, you know, we are arch enemies with Hell's Angels, so the Crosby 1%, and we were 17 years of age, and, you know, like 25, 30. And I was in college as well, and one of my...
So they're rockers, aren't they? Your mods, they're rockers. Yeah, yeah. Like from Quadrophenia, the film.
Yeah, but it was the end of that era. Yeah. You know, it comes to the end of the era, because the skinheads would come to the fore anyway. But I there was all things. So I covered a lot of my teenage years as well, which were... There was funny things, because I'd started as a paint and decorator with Norwest Holston Apprentice. There's lots of funny things on there. And then I got involved with the trade union. At 17, I became an apprentice with UCAT. I've become a trade union member with UCAT as an apprentice. And years later, when I become branch secretary of Bootle UDO 39, myself and the former chair and treasurer of UCAT, Terry and Phil, we went to collect all the books from the former secretary who passed away, John. And he'd been the Bootle UCAT secretary since about 1960. It was originally the Amalgamated Carpenters Union, I think it was. And he had all the books going back, and meaning, like, there were just tons of books, and in it I found Robert Brennan Apprentice 50p in the book. So, from, you know, that was really nice to see that. And of course, there was things on the site. I'd become a shop steward. I didn't realise at the time that Norwest were signatories to the Economic League, which is the blacklist. And we had GFs and foremen that were, you know, Daily Mail reading blue Tories. And the hatred that was directed towards me, and the things that was done to me as the apprentice, you know, once I became a steward, was awful. Yeah. And then it impacted on me when I went to apply for jobs elsewhere as well. So I cover all that in the book, and I cover, obviously, situation with my family. I didn't get on with my dad for many years. My dad was, not only was a gambler, he was a prolific gambler, and he was a womaniser. The violence as well, you know, was... Think nothing of hitting you. You know, I was thrashed with a belt. I was punched. My mother would just let it happen. And then looking back, my dad's family, his father, did the same. But it was bizarre because he thrashed his boys but turned the pitch of the Sacred Heart. He turned the pitch to face the wall before he thrashed his boys. I mean, both families, my dad's family came over in the turn of the century. They were Catholic, Irish Catholics, and settled in Reading Street and off Scotland Road. My mum's family, McGailey, they came over at the turn of the century and settled in Marsh Lane. So there was two Irish Catholic families, and they both married Protestants. The Catholics were both married Protestants. In fact, my dad's mother was also called Brennan. So you had a Catholic and Irish and a Protestant family, both, you know, same name. And the way it was, they went to, you know, my dad and his brothers and sisters brought up as Catholics. My mum was brought up as a Catholic. I met and married my wife Leslie. She was Protestant, Church of England. It didn't bother me any of that because we were all christened. didn't matter. I wasn't bothered about, you know, a Catholic upbringing. I mean, the two of our children went to St. Rovabella, went to right opposite the school where we live. But that was more out of convenience because it was just there. But we had to take our vows in St. Rovabella's church because the church didn't recognise our registry office wedding. It wasn't sanctioned by the Lord. So we've done all that. So I covered all that, and there's lots of things, and I say, but there's the issues about getting, when I first joined the Labour Party, that's the similarities I saw then as I did with Oral Mount Park, and now we weren't prepared to support residents and support, you know, local people because they would oppose them, because they'd stood against them. And I saw that in Skelmersdale. You had 400,000 building workers unemployed nationally. Skelmersdale unemployment was, you know, it was about one in four. With nationally, it was 1 in 10. Skelmersdale was decimated. And the Trades Council in Skelmersdale were made of, again, of likes of Communist Party members, the Communist Party of Great Britain, the New Communist Party. And they did all the work. They formed the National Employed Marches. They were coordinating them. I was the only Labour Party member to get involved with that, with the centre. We had an unemployed workers' centre in Skelmersdale. And that was right facing the leader of the council, Lancashire County Council's husband's chemist office shop. But they never supported the centre. They didn't give it any money whatsoever. So it relied solely on donations from the trade union branches that were affiliated to the Trade Council. But he's done lots of stirring work. I mean, you're looking at food cooperatives before food banks were even existing, and we had them in Skelmersdale.
So you're saying that they didn't support them because they were technically in the Communist Party?
Yeah.
And the Labour Party didn't like that?
Yeah, they wouldn't support anything that the Communist Party, any non-Labour Party activists were involved in. And I saw that with Oral Mount Park. They weren't prepared to support, meet the friends of residents of Oral Mount Park. They weren't prepared to meet them because they'd stood against them.
So just for context, there's a field not far from our house called Oral Mount Park, and they were going to turn it into some astro pitches. And there was a lot of local opposition saying it's a green space, leave it as it is and put the pitches elsewhere. And there was a lot of animosity between local residents and the Labour Party. And what you're saying is a lot of people in the Labour Party said some of those residents have bad-mouthed us and stood against us, so therefore we're not interested in what they've got to say.
Yeah. And, of course, I met with the residents because, again, you look at the code of conduct for the local government councillors and the Nolan principles of that, you actually meet with your residents and you can't turn around and say, I'm not prepared to meet with you because you didn't vote for me or you stood against, because you represent all the electorate whether you vote for you or not. And I met with the residents and they had very legitimate concerns. Of course, I lived here and all my friends and neighbours were all were worried about what was going on over there. The other councillors didn't live in the area. They represented those wards but didn't actually live in the immediate vicinity. And they were not prepared to meet with the residents of that group because they'd stood against them as independents. You can't have that. The reason people stand as independents is because they're not satisfied with what the local elected members are doing. Well, again, and that reminds me of you know, it's like I say in the book, you know, we've been here before because I've seen it in Skelmersdale when the Labour Party wouldn't support the Trades Council's unemployed workers' centre, wouldn't give them any funding. And again, it's, you know, we're not supporting them because of, you know, X, Y, and Z's involved. And you can't, you know, to me, politics is about internationalism. It's a broad, you know, politics is a broad. And, you know, you don't get on unless you're prepared to work with all others. I mean, you worked here as a trade union. So why not work together as a political party with other parties to get things done locally? And I've found since I've been a councillor, when I've worked with people who have been opposed to the Labour Party, you know, things have been done. And I always show, you know, respect to people who stand against me. I remember the Socialist Alternative stood against the Labour Party, I think it was 2000, it might have been 2004. And when the Socialist Alternative candidate got up to speak, they were like booed and people walked out. Well, I think that's appalling because, you know, this is a person who stood. And it was rather strange because a lot of people were actually voting for me and the Socialist Alternative candidate because there was two seats up. And, of course, I had people saying to me, why are they voting for, you know, you and why did you just not vote for two Labour? That's just bizarre. And even with likes of the allotments, there was people, a person who's passed away, and I was very, you know, spoke very out, you know, out about the Labour Party and things not getting done. And I supported him to get a disabled path through the allotments. And you've got to do that. You've got to work with residents, you know, whether you want to. I mean, there's people I thought, they've said things about me and this study, but at the end of the day, you know, you've been elected And the way to you change hearts and minds, and you can't do that by ignoring people. You've got to work with people. And I have to say, the people that I've worked with who've had grievances in regards to what Labour weren't doing, I'd say they've turned out to be right.
So, well, just rewinding a little, what's the current title of your book, or what are you going with at the minute?
A Glittering Malice.
A Glittering Malice. We'll come to that in a moment. So, you're on holiday. Roger McGough, he's like a beat poet from Liverpool. You read his book, you go, I associate with a lot of that. You get this idea. Now, you've just spoken there so fluidly for 15 minutes while I'm looking at your notes. It's like, this stuff's in your head, isn't it? Yeah. And I think getting it out, I mean, there's a lot of local stuff there, the allotments of the plots where people grow their own stuff. You've mentioned about the field. You've mentioned you were always willing to work with people who weren't in the party, the Labour Party, because that's what you've got to do. Now, I grew up in the 80s, and looking back now, the 80s is as far away from now as the 80s were from the 40s. And what you describe about the 60s and the 70s, I remember the tail end of that, the Catholic Protestant thing. Like now, people don't even know, do they? A lot of the kids don't even know, which is a good thing locally. Kez, when I went to school, it was still quite Kez-like. And if you haven't seen the film Kez, which is based on the book by Barry Hines, and it was made into a film by Ken Loach, which really captured that kind of social realism, the best of British cinema at the time. I recently watched the film Threads about nuclear war in 84, which was again made by Barry Hines with the Yorkshire context. It was like that, and it captured something honest and true about what it was like for many people in poorer parts of the UK, particularly in the north of England. And I've heard some historians say a lot of the stuff about the north of England being underprivileged dates back to William the Conqueror with the Harrying of the North and all that, when he said, I'm going to put down these rebellions. He just went around killing people left, right and centre. And the north is considered the industrial heartlands of the UK. There's a lot of poverty in the north today. So you grew up in all this. You've got the religious stuff going on, problems at home, growing up. You touch on this kind of like what it was like on these tough estates before computers and mobile phones. And you've also mentioned that kind of like, what are you lot doing now? Do you get back to your own area? Which I remember hearing when I was a kid as well. And it's very much like you've kind of represented the zeitgeist of what I remember growing up. And to put that into a book, you don't get many books like that, do you? And I think this is an important book. And you've got the formal politics to go alongside it, haven't you?
Yeah, and again, I cover a lot about school. I mean, I went to the Holy Ghost school. It's now called the Holy Spirit, but it was called Holy Ghost then. I sat alongside other Sefton councillors. I mean, the current MP for Bootle, Peter, Peter Dowd, was my classmate. Well, we would have competitions with the... there was a couple of lads sat behind us, Jeff and Alex, and we would have quiz games against them. It was like a mini version of the University Challenge. We challenged them to all sorts of questions, and be thanks sort of thing. Question like, well, who's the president of Botswana and things like that? Because Peter would bring in his Britannia Encyclopedia, and of course they wouldn't know the answer.
So Peter Dowd's the current Bootle.
Yeah.
So all the areas you've mentioned are all in Bootle area, all Boundary Lane, Air Ford.
Yeah.
And then up the coast, you've got Formby, which is considered what might be termed the posher part.
I actually said cover Formby as well in Ainsdale as things when I was mayor of Sefton. And that, again, people will be eye-opened by some of the things. But just getting back to when I was at primary school, we'd have these, and again, it's all in the book, we'd have these like University Challenge, and the lads behind us wouldn't get the answers. And they'd come up with, for example, and I remember it quite clear, because one said, where did Davy Crockett die? And I said, it was the Alamo. And then said to Peter, my dad took me to see the film, as he did. So we knew that one. And we got, you know, we won the competition. But strange enough, both me and Peter failed off 11 plus, and Jeff and Alex went on to Salesian College, and we didn't.
So Salesian College, which is a comprehensive now, that was a grammar school for past the 11 plus.
So we went to St. Thomas Aquinas. That school had a shocking reputation. I mean, you know, I make reference to it. I mean, I was there for 4 years. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But in that school, and I've had this conversation with Peter as well. I mean, Peter said to me, oh, you've gone on okay there, because the teachers that we had, like, they're all rugby teachers. I mean, my form teacher was Mike Collins, who played for Lee rugby team. I done well athletics. I used to represent the school in the 4x100 metres relay, the 1500 metres, the cross country. I played for the school football team. So if you, and that's all that mattered for that school. I mean, they always won the Bootle School's trophies every year. I mean, academically wise, I mean, I don't think it really, you know, they win that fussed on that because we. But if you excelled in sports, then you know that you went a long way. And I still got my certificates upstairs on the. We'd have done the 1500 metres and the 1400 metres on the same within half an hour of each other. And I go through St. Tommy's and some of the things that happened in there as well, you know, like sort of the daily canings and that. And of course, I had the paper round, so if it was, you know, you were late getting in, and I was late because two of my friends were always scrapping with each other over who was the hardest on the day, and that was and that'd be the referee, and obviously they'd disagree with my decisions if they'd fight again. So we were always late getting in, so I was always caned. It was a democratic sort of corporal punishment administered there. You either got detention or you got the cane, because I had the paper on, I had to have the cane all the time. And there was one teacher one time said to me, "Oh, no, you're on detention. I'm going to canes for more, you know, befitting sort of crimes and type things and all that." So, and I had to write. And what it was, we'd have, you'd stare out the window because you'd have, you know, if there's a football match, school football match going on for another year, you know, during the day or that, or even like sort of, one of the ones, if when girls from the schools used to come and use the school fields to practice on, so you'd all be staring out the windows. And I got caught out the window, so I had to be. I was on detention. It was like I must not stare out the school window during a class window during. I must not stare out the window during class. I tried that 100 times, and I wrote it. It was about 4:20. I said, "No, sir, I've done that." He said, "Sit down, Brennan. You've still got 10 minutes to go." So I spent the next 10 minutes staring out the window, watching the deputy head whacking a golf ball on the school field. It's bizarre, and it's little things like that. And you know, we had a school out into Penmanmar where three of the teachers, the art teachers, were. They decided to take six of us to Conway, just outside Conway, a place called Penmanmar, I think it was. And he had to write a book, sorry, a little story, why would you like to go to Wales so for just, the weekend?
So people know Wales. Yeah. Conway's got a huge castle. It's like a good place for trips from Liverpool.
Yeah. So he had to write why I'd like to go to Conway for the weekend. They went on the Friday, come back on the Sunday. Well, I excelled at English in school, so I wrote a really good, quite a meaningful article that I wrote about why I'd like to go, and it was supposed to be like just a, you know, a few paragraphs. No, I think I must have wrote half a book. And I was ill in school one day, and I was sat outside the headmaster's office in a chair because I'd come across unwell. And then one of the artists around, he says, "How did you feel?" I said, "Oh, I'm okay now, sir." And he said, "Well, good news is you're going to Wales. You're fascinated with your book." He said, "It was like, you know, what you'd put." He said, "It was really." He said, "So we went for a few days, and that was the first time we experienced public school boys, because while we were in Conway Castle, there was a regrettably for the St. Thomas Aquinas teachers, there was public school boys also there, and they were in uniform, and we weren't. We were all in, like, you know, jeans and that." They actually heard us talk and started trying to, you know, mimic us. And
so this is a private school. Yeah. We call public schools in the UK, don't we, private schools for some reason. So they're there at the same time. Bit of a culture shock, wasn't it?
Yeah. And of course, I mean, I'd say it's as regretting for this is a bit from the book. It's as regretting for the teachers. Our visit coincides with the party public school boys, some of whom, on hearing our accents, decided to pour scorn on us. That resulted in our hurling hands full of gravel at them, following which they beat a hasty retreat, cursing us as ruffians as we cheered that they're leaving, further lobbing gravel at them from the castle ramparts. I was going, "But sir, we're defending the school." That was that. So it was things like that. And then when I left school, during summer holidays, I wanted to go back because I enjoyed the weekend that much. Because, I mean, you didn't get away living in Bootle, you know, you didn't get away much. So me and my friends, we went camping. We went back to Penmanmar, to the same caravan campsite. But we were only there. We went on the Saturday, but we were ejected from the site on the Wednesday. It's all things like that. And there's, you know, it's boys being boys and things like that. It wasn't. When I lived on the estate, I mean, on the Ford estate, there was no burglaries. I mean, if there was people's electric meters and gas meters were stolen, but tend to be by the occupants of the house themselves. Because we had one boy come round. We had a couple of lads on the estate that we didn't bother with, but they were always getting into trouble for doing things like breaking in. So there was a school for, it was actually called St. Luke's Adult Training Centre at the time, and obviously it was a school for people who had, you know, severe learning difficulties and things like that. Well, they would break into there and steal the ice cream, and they were always getting in trouble. So you know who the ne'er-do-wells were on the estate, and we didn't really associate with them, and, you know, we put them down as being quite a bit odd. But one day one of them came round and treated us to, do you want to come to New Brighton? And we were all like puzzled, New Brighton. So we enter New Brighton, we went across the ferry, the fair, Wimpy Burgers and everything. And when we come back, we didn't even ask where the money had come from, because we were just, oh, great, let's go to New Brighton for the day. And apparently he'd stole his dad's tontine or the Christmas Club money that his dad was saving for the works. And this was August, so it was a fair amount that had been stolen. Yeah. So there's things that, and another occasion where I was at home, the electric went, and I put my hand up on the mantelpiece to get what I thought was a 2 shilling piece, ten pence piece. Put it in the meter, and it come on, and when they come again, I realised I put my foreign coins in there, which is also on the mantelpiece. So not having any pocket money, obviously, it was great, so I kept the 10 pence piece. And weeks later, I kept putting these foreign coins in and keeping the money. I overheard my mum say one time that she's looking forward to rebate when the lecky man comes to read the meter. Well, when he did come read the meter, there was hell to pay, because all it was foreign coins.
So they had to pay. So,
you know, it there's a lot of stuff like that. But also, again, you know, cover that bit, because it's funny, and it's things that happens, and I say my friends were really, you know, I had wonderful friends, we were great friends, and the sad thing about it now, I had a close-knit of friends, there's about, you know, six or seven of us, I'm the only one that's still alive.
Really?
Yeah, you know, which is quite sad, they've all passed away. And two of them passed away in the 40s, one of them, his dad had history of heart trouble, that died. And he also died as well. But then I found out that, you know, they'd all passed away. And I only learned because I moved away from Bootle. My mum moved in 1974. My mum straight out of the blue said, we're moving. And we moved to Skelmersdale. Well, that was, you know, completely, you know, new to me. My granddad had moved up then. I thought she was going to visit my granddad, but she was doing the house exchange. So I moved away and I lost...
Was that a new town as it was at the time? So it's like a new town. It's meant to be these, like, utopias on the edge of the cities where people can go and live, yeah?
Yeah, and he had major employers like Thorns, but within 6 months of, I think, of me moving up there, Thorns had closed and Courtauld's closed and... So it was the big employers had gone. I think what they did, they were encouraged to come in because of all the grants that they could obtain, and then next minute they've gone. But we moved up there, you know, unbeknown to me, and it comes as a shock. So I lost contact with my friends, and the only learned of their faith years later when I was in the legal profession, and there was actually in solicitor's office in Netherton. And some other lads that I knew from school had come in. They weren't like close friends, but I knew them as, you know, and they would tell me about what's happened. And one of the taxi drivers, our postman now, he's the son of lads that I used to know at school. And his uncle was a taxi driver and he's just retired. And his uncle, Jimmy, would say to me, hey, Bobby, you know, because we were in school together, played football together. He said, we heard the so-and-so. And then you realise, you know, all your friends have gone, but mine. Out of all my friends, you know, I mean, we were stuck together like glue. And I think that there's...
We just say to the listeners, well, Bob, you might not be 21, but, like, it's not like you're knocking on the door yet. You're not, like, someone who's really, really old, are
well,
you?
Well, I'm 69 this year, so, you know...
I wanted you to say it,
I'm 69 this year. And there's a line in the film that Stand By Me, it says, you know, I never had friends like I did when I was at school. Mm. And that's quite true. Yeah. And I think, you know, the bonding that we had, when I think back now, some of the things, and I look back with fondness, but also, I think that's why I want to get in the book, because it's important. They were good times. There's a chap called Sid Webster, they called him the Rhyming Fireman. Sid wrote books. We lived on the same estate, and he wrote a book called Growing Up in Ford, which I would have called it that, but Sid already wrote his book, and he covers some of the things in his book that I also do. You know, and I mention him in this book. So, you know, Sid Webster mentions a lot of the people on the estate because I played football for likes of the Taylor's Arms, which is the Cookson's pub. And now, I refer to that because people say the Cookson's Bridge. Well, it's the Gorsey Lane Bridge, and it's got on a Gorsey Lane Bridge in 1935, or the thing it is. And the Cookson's pub was to Taylor's Arms, and it was run by Jimmy Cookson and his dad, old Jimmy Cookson. And it was always known as Cookson's, so now the pub's called Cookson's Bridge.
Yeah.
But no one really knows the origins of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the Taylor's Arms, and it was run by Jimmy Cookson. Well, I played the Taylor's Arms. So it's all things like that I cover. And there's a piggeries at the back of it with the old piggeries where we, my friend, used to go. We used to like get potatoes off the farmer's field and cook them in the piggeries. Yes. And we'd have our fires on elevated positions so we could see anyone coming from White's farm when they see the smoke. There's all things that, and there used to be a. In fact, I deliver training on modern-day slave and human trafficking, and I cover the Magdalen nurseries. Yeah. And what people don't know, there was a Magdalen nursery in Ford, in what was then the old convent. There was the Convent of the Good Shepherd, which used to be on Sterrick's Lane. Well, that wasn't pulled down in about 1971. They knocked it down, but the orchard still remained. Well, we used to go and raid the orchard on a regular basis. Me and my friends in Group 4 were always there. I don't know, like, there was nothing to protect, just the actual, yeah, the orchard. But that was a convent. The nursery van used to come round. The van used to come round, like, so, for laundry, you know, come round the estate. And I covered that in my training because people don't realise that, you know, young women were actually incarcerated in there.
For having children out of wedlock?
Mainly for that reason, yeah. And again, that convent was in Sterrick's Lane and Ford. And when I delivered my training on human trafficking and modern-day slavery, I covered that, Magdalen laundries. And they also had nurseries where the children were born and put in these nurseries. And there's been horrendous tales and you know, of the amount of deaths of newborns and things like that, particularly in Magdalen nurseries in Ireland. You know, again, it's like, that was in Ford, that was there, that was convent, was actually, yeah, on that estate. So I cover all things like that.
Yeah. I mean, they've had a lot of truth and reconciliation in Ireland about the, yeah, Magdalen laundries and what, yeah, there's films about it, books about it, but I didn't know we had one over here up until 71.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
literally, they found babies' bodies, women were disgraced. Yeah. It happens around the world in different places where you have supposed religious authorities,
yeah,
treating people as just almost like non-human beings, you know what I mean? It is shocking, yeah, isn't it?
But I cover all that because it's all about, I mean, you know, things in Ford, and people won't remember, and then if they live, they think, well, didn't they know this was here? There was a cork factory actually on the canal, which went up in flames about 1964. We used to see the barges taking all the cork there, but that went up in flames. So I cover all things like growing up in Ford, but also, I mean, King Avenue, when I was born there. And as I say, when I became a councillor, it was Oddle Ward. It wasn't Nether and Oddle. It was just the one ward Oddle, and you had the one ward Netherton. After boundary changes, become like sort of Nether and Oddle, because what we wanted to do was retain the Oddle name, where it was in. It originally just going to be Nether. But we said no, because part of the ward falls into what was Old Oddle, so that's why it became Netherton and Oddle. But I was born in King Avenue, and I say, like, you know, like in the Spinners, you know, was born in Liverpool down by the docks. Mm. Well, it was not quite the docks, but you could see the dock cranes in the corner of the street. But more so, we were at the back of Walton Prison, what was then the Canada dock line run along it. I cover all that. And for example, the cockroaches, when I was a child, my mum said they used to put vim and Ajax, the bed legs, so the cockroaches didn't climb into the bed. Well, I can't remember the cockroaches as a child. You know, when we moved back to Bootle in 1984, we came on what was called the National Mobility Exchange Scheme. You transfer from one authority to another. Any expectations of getting decent housing is obviously, you know, is dashed, because you're not going to get something that other people that can't have. You tend to get low priority housing. And to be fair, why should people be jumped the queue? You know, so I understood that. So, but we were off to a house in Marsh Avenue, which is adjoining to King Avenue. I mean, overrun with cockroaches the first night we were there. You know, my wife Leslie, she took the quarter cockroach and took the eggs like jelly beans down to the local housing office. And again, that's in the book. And then he moved us to the Park Lane estate, which is infamously known as Dodge. And people didn't want to live there, but I knew a lot of the families on there. My friends, you know, there's still a lot of families on there. And I also knew, so we didn't find it problematic at all. Well, you know, it was a nice estate. Mm. And I got involved in politics then. Because the Labour Party was shutting down the Netherton Park Community Centre and turned off the Lecky. Well, I was supporting the families with getting the hot tea, you know, their flasks and that for them. Cockroaches were then, you know, we had a problem with the ingress of mice, because when he pulled down Brabies and Bridle Road, all the mice, you know, sought refuge on the estate. So I covered all things of that. And then I had a job at Aldermaston as well, the Atomic Weapons Establishment. And when you look at the, you know, the Queen and the you know, forces, dark forces, and the, you know, the men in black, well, I experienced that at Aldermaston in the interview process and things like that. I got to a point where I was suffered with really bad depression. I was prescribed a thiazide. I was unwell. I eventually decided I've got to do something with my life because I couldn't get a job in my trade, and I was blacklisted. Found that out to be the case. I was on one site. Again, I covered a lot about the trade union because I was on one site in Ormskirk, and a guy came up to me, the college manager, and he said, "You're a shop steward at Norwest." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Causing trouble, you'll have your legs broke." And that was a general foreman. And I had things like that, you know, I come across that a lot of times within the trade, you know, as a trade union steward. And when I got back involved with the Labour Party, which was not till about 1990, got back involved with the Labour Party. And I got back involved with trade unions first. I got active again the trade unions with the Trades Council. And we were setting up an unemployed centre in St Thomas' Church in Seaforth. I was then the Assistant Secretary of Merseyside Trade Union Councils. And one of the people behind the push to get a trade union centre re-established in Sefton, and there was one originally in about 1984, 86, in Waterloo. And that closed down because what they said was financial irregularities. Well, it wasn't. There was people who were, you know, given likes of monies to pay lecky bills, is what I was told. It wasn't anything to live with financial irregularity. It was just helping people out. Well, it was closed down by the trade unions. And they wouldn't recognise other union and the trade union centre in Sefton while members of the old centre involved. And we were arguing, because they were not involved in anything. There was no fraud. There was nothing like that. It was just, you know, so why should you stop trade unions being back involved and set up a new centre? So we had to struggle getting that centre set up. But one of the people involved, Paul, he's now an Anglican priest, Paul. Well, he rang me one day and I heard clicking on the phone. It's on the house phone. And I said, "Do you hear that clicking, Paul?" We'll continue this conversation another time. And then there's the secretary of the Merseyside Associate Trade Union Councils rang me one time as well. And I said to him, "Can you hear that?" And he said, "Your phone's tapped." And I thought, this is bizarre, you know. So I actually rang BT and I said, "Because my phone tapped." And BT actually said, we don't know, and we wouldn't know if it was. It wouldn't be anything to do with us. And what confirmed that then Paul said to me, we were arranged that we're looking at European funding through the Anglican Church and, you know, European funding initiatives. And he was involved with these metal workers in Italy. And he said to me one day, he said, Special Branch actually rang him and said, knew about this conversation. And Paul said, "Well, how do you know about that? I've only had a phone call." And so Paul said, being listened into. And you wonder why, you know, their trade union members were subject to sort of, you know, being snooped on and phones happen, because I can only assume that the trade unions in Italy and that with the Communist Party members involved. But that was sort of, to me, when you hear things like that, and I did in scams, like people say to me, my phone's been tapped, and I think, oh, don't be daft, you know, it doesn't exist, that doesn't go on. Well, it does. Yeah. As I experience it. And when you've got people who are very much in you know, clergy, who have experienced the same thing, then that's a, you know, it really is quite a shocking indictment.
An enemy of the state, an enemy of the state. I mean, I worked for the teachers' trade union for 18 months, and I think that, you know, you don't have to scratch the surface by speaking to people about what it's like for many people in the workplace, the conditions that they put up with. I mean, Britain's supposed to be like unemployment's meant to be quite low at the moment, but the actual quality of a lot of the jobs is absolutely appalling. And I mean, it's almost like a different world, or a world people don't talk about, because the stuff I saw in the teaching union, don't get me wrong, like, it wasn't like, you know, a general workers union and like that, was shocking, appalling practice. It's very much comes from a different time. You know, you're talking about during the Cold War, when the British state was snooping on people who they considered a threat. I spoke to a woman whose phone was tapped after she said suspected people were going through rubbish as well, because she attended, you know, the anti-nuclear protests that the women went on. What was that called, that place? Common?
Green and Common.
Yeah. Green and Common. But it's fascinating to reminisce about it, but also to see how ever-present those kind of things are. The other thing, I read a great book by David Mitchell called Black Swan Green. He grew up in Southport. He had a bit of a stammer, not the comedian, another guy. And he describes like going on journeys into the surrounding areas of your town when you were a kid, and describes, in his case, growing up in the 80s. And it's so rich for people who experience that to read that in books, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just brings back those very, very powerful memories.
When I was in Skelmersdale Labour Party, they were affiliated to CND. The branch was affiliated to CND. And it was a fundraiser arranged for
campaign for nuclear disarmament.
Yeah, and there was a fundraiser arranged just to support, you know, the local branch. And it was, you know, it was a teacher's home that the fundraiser was at. A few hours. I mean, the extreme right wing activists forced their way into the home and set about assaulting people. The police were called, and the police came 45 minutes later. Just one sergeant and a young female officer. We were all questioned, and then the CND lit information was taken away. The branch was closed down, and not one right-wing activist was dragged in.
Funnily enough, I remember supposedly radical magazines getting taken by the police 15 years ago in Liverpool. There's a magazine called The Nerve. It's far from radical. And yet you look at what the Daily Mail and some of the right-wing press print every day, you know.
Yeah, no, I think the police and under Thatcher and the Tories, I'd like to think that, you know, the TUs, the police... I mean, you've only got to look at the miners and the way that the police were used there. I'm very supportive. I think that the police do a really great job.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think the police officers now are not politicised, be used politically as they were under Thatcher. She saw it as her own private sort of army, and they were used. And I actually cover sort of, in the book, I also cover like sort of, you know, as a Liverpool football fan, I cover Hillsborough. I wasn't at Hillsborough, I watched it at home and watched it don't fail on television. I wouldn't have gone to semi-final anyway. I used to go all the games, as a teenager, but I wouldn't have been at Hillsborough. So I tore with Hillsborough at the aftermath and taken my two scarves, one from the 1960s, a Liverpool scarf, and the other one from the 1970s, and I took the one scarf, tied it to the cop barrier and swore I'd never stand on the terraces again. And I took me the scarf and tied it in the other, a link between Everton, the Liverpool's grounds, a chain of scarves, Liverpool, yeah. Everton scarf, and then tied one scarf in that. So I cover Hillsborough and the way, you know, Thatcher, you know, the cover-ups then, and again, you look at, like, you know, Heseltine, he was sent in, you know, and to be fair to Heseltine, I actually mentioned the book, you know, he at least tried, he was... You know, looking to help people, you know, on Merseyside with regeneration. But Thatcher was like the view.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, he wanted to just let it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's quite controversial, really. Heseltine came in after the riots, the Toxteth riots, yeah, in Liverpool, and invested a lot of state money here. But there were people in the cabinet who said, just let Liverpool wither, yeah, away. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the police in the 80s, as you say, Thatcher, she paid them well. And they became very politicised, and I wouldn't like to be in the police today. You know, you stretch thinner. You know, it's a more difficult job. But the kind of things that happened to other trades has now happened to the police with all the cuts.
Yeah.
But Thatcher used them, didn't she, in the 80s?
Yeah. I think that the police are now, I mean, when I first came to council, we had great community police officers on the beat, and you knew that, you know, it was brilliant. Sooner we were able to return to having more bobbies on the beat is better, because then people from the community can, you know... Mm. And I think... The other thing is the intelligence gathering as well. People are more likely to speak to police officers that they see regularly on the beat and all that. And I miss that scene of the local police officers around. Getting back to Hills, because I'll come on to that. I'll talk about, like, football fans. And I mentioned sort of the hatred between Liverpool and Everton supporters. Now there's that bitterness. And I think, you know, I've never really found the reason why there's been sort of, you know, that bitterness and that hatred. It wasn't like that when I was a kid, because the former Everton reserve goalkeeper, Andy Rankin, who was to Gordon West, well, his dad lived in Hampshire Avenue and used to get us tickets for the ground. And we'd only be paying like sort of 25p more than the actual cost of the ticket. But we'd go to Gladys Street if it was, you know, at Everton. I would be in the Anfield Road end, was at Liverpool. But you were in there mixed with the Everton fans, and you had your Liverpool scarf on. And it was never, there was nothing at all. There was no animosity. But, I mean, I think Everton would have won the European Cup in, I think, about 86. That team probably would have won the European Cup. So I think, the bannings, the football clubs being banned, and when that's all part and parcel, but I've gone about how the clubs came together over Hillsborough, and I cover very much that. And then, you know, like, and it was called the 3-day week, the blackouts, the miners' strike as well. You know, in the 1970s, when we had the 3-day week and the blackouts, and that was a strange time to be around. I mean, we had a family that had a gas cooker, so when the Echo used to put, like, this area's going to be blacked out, so you're looking to say 4 to be blacked out between, say, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And then you'd have like Lidl and we'd be blacked out between, say, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock the following day. So you'd look across the road and it'd be completely blackout. No streetlights, everything. And your estate would be all lights up and vice versa. Well, one time we were at one of the neighbours' houses getting tea because they had the gas cooker. And then we heard like the Baines' milk flood getting driven round the road. And it was my mate that actually did, took it. And they were singing No Milk Today by Herman's Hermits. So I cover all stuff like that and the 3 day week. And I actually go into local politics. I mean, I again, Thatcher and Heseltine, I cover that, the miners' strike as well. Because my brother-in-law was on strike for the whole year. He was in a pit in Nottingham. He was one of only 20 that walked out. He was on strike for the whole year. And my sister had her windows broken by families of miners that were actually working. And whatever people said about Arthur Scargill, I mean, you know, he was right. You know, he was right when he said, again, you know, we went on pit marches, closure marches. I've been on two unemployed marches. And I mentioned the other things, you know, you're on unemployed marches, there's a big banner, people's march for jobs, and you've got people shouting, "I get a job, you lazy bastards," and things like that. And I think, well, that's what the banner says, we're marching for jobs. So, and then I went on pit march jobs, and I've got a photograph there with me and Leslie with Arthur Scargill with his arms around us. You know, that's like sort of, whatever people thought of him, he was right.
Yeah.
You know,
he was... Again, he's a controversial figure, like with the culture wars and all that, but he said the whole mining industry is going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And do you know if the government would have done like a transition and helped those communities and all that, but he didn't?
No.
It turned into a huge culture war issue. I'm still angry about that now. And I remember when I was a kid, my mum giving a packet of biscuits to some miners when we were on a school trip. We went past some striking miners. But it was a shocking time in the 80s, because that's when that culture war became a big issue, which is still ongoing now.
Well, Thatcher was never going to forgive the miners for what they did to Heath, bringing the Heath government down. And that thing, that changed trade unionism. You know, that was the start of the collapse of trade unionism. So you smashed the trade union movement. And I think after that, I think the trade unions now... Okay, people said to me, "Oh, well, you don't get all the strikes that you did then," but people were striking for reasons. Right. I mean, the miners went on strike. I mean, they were grossly underpaid in the 1970s. They were on strike because my brother-in-law, I mean, working down a pit for 10 hours, whatever, you know. And but in the 1970s, the miners were grossly underpaid, and all they wanted was to be, you know, a decent living wage. And that's what people have gone on strike for. You know, it's not about, you know, I used to see all the 70s, oh, Red Robbo and Leyland and things like that. Leyland Motors always on strike, Ford's always on strike. People don't go on strike unless they have to.
You also have monetarism, the whole idea of monetarism. The unemployment went up for 3 million. That was the policy of monetarism. Yeah. She had a terrible start. It was only the Falklands War, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe Labour not being organised, that meant that she won those other elections. But I would even go as far to say what Thatcher did to this country. I mean, she might appear quite moderate in many ways now.
Yeah.
But she divided this country, and I don't think we've ever recovered from it, you know what I mean?
As a shop steward, I mean, I become the UCAT's youngest federation steward. I'm still an apprentice. And I'm in the book, actually, for using the expletives, but in the book, I asked this foreman who came on, who was a dyed-in-the-wool tour, Daily Mail reading blue. He actually came over to me and his very words were, "Hey, fucky, what are you trying to do to the site?" Because Norwest had brought in lumpers to finish the painting off, and I got UCAT involved, and I became the steward. Two managers from Norwest Hulse came to the site along with the site agent into the house where I was painting, and quite menacingly demanded the names of all the trade union members from the Skelmersdale UCAT and Trades Council branch. And I reported back to UCAT, and Jimmy Cousins, who was then one of the organisers, came up. The site was shut down, threatened to shut the site down. And the lumpers never got a hold. But what they did then, Norwest then sent me to Penwortham, Pensby, Pulteney Files, you know, just to get me away. There's lots of in about the trade unions and what went on. And, you know, it's growing up. It's like holidays and the holidays that we didn't have, the holidays that we did have. For people who know about painting and decorating, there's the Builder's Bible, the Painter's Bible, the Ragged Trouser Philanthropist.
Oh, what a book.
Well, when I finished my apprenticeship as apprentice, and I qualified as a painter and sign writer, because you do a lot of, you know, signs, and I do a lot of, like, still life and cartoon characters, and one time there was a friend of mine who was a Labour councillor in Skelmersdale, and he was a teacher in Delfside County Primary. Well, he didn't have any art teachers, so I would voluntarily take a class one day a week, well, for an hour, and do, like, art. The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, there's a foreman called Nimrod, Well, again, working on the sites, me and I work for Unit Construction, and I pals up with a guy from London called Bill, and we become great friends, and we work together for quite a while, different companies. Well, on the bonuses that they give you to doing houses, you couldn't really make any money on it. So you have to what's called wally the walls, which you use a flat brush, to 8-inch flat brush, sorry, 7-inch flat brush to paint the walls. So we used to get a roll, sheepskin roller, roll the ceilings, and then just wipe them over with a brush so you didn't see the roller marks. And he frowned, he wouldn't let you use a roller. But the only way you could make money by was doing the rolling of ceilings, rolling the walls, and just going over the flat brush. There was one time the door was getting banged on. It was the foreman. And we weren't going to open it. We had the radio on loud, so we couldn't come in. And we said, well, the radio didn't hear you. Next minute, we heard the noise, and he was banging on the back window. He put a lad up to the back window, was looking through us at us.
That sounds like something the Crash would do, yeah, in the Ragged Trash.
Yeah. And so we nicknamed him Nimrod.
But he had experience of that trade, didn't he?
Yeah,
Robert,
yeah.
Tressel. Yeah. And he's buried in
Rice Lane Farm.
I think what you capture as well is you capture like the local, the personal, the political and the regional and the international are all linked together. Do you know what I mean? And you've got to cite all those other things because of the influence of that.
Well, again, when I got back involved with the Labour Party and become, a councillor, I've always been very much involved in being always anti-fascist. I've always been interested in the Spanish Civil War, yeah, and the International Brigade. As I got our branch to send a donation to the Harama Memorial Association, and the secretary then was a guy called Walter Greenall. Walter was actually a painter and decorator by trade, and he lived in Manchester. He's a member of the Communist Party of Great Britain. Well, he actually went forth in Spain as a machine gunner. Mm. And he formed the Harama Memorial Association. At the same time, he had the International Brigade Association, which the secretary was Bill Alexander. And we'd sent a donation to Bill Alexander, to the International Brigade, and also to the Harama Memorial Association.
Just for context, it was a 1936 battle where lots of people from the International Brigade were killed, including a lot of people from Liverpool.
Yeah.
There's a great monument in the Unite building in Liverpool. Have you seen that?
Well, again, in this book, I cover this because after the Battle of Harama, all the brigadistas, the brigadiers that volunteers that were Republicans and the International Brigade brigadistas that were actually killed, they were disinterred and he was put in a rubbish dump. There was a big old dug in the place called Alcalá de Henares, and he was thrown in what was then designated, covered in broken glass, and it was designated a rubbish dump, and that's how it was for years. 15 years ago, there was probably still a cloud of amnesia over Spain let's not talk about the International Brigade and the Civil War and things like that. They were looking to have, in the spirit of reconciliation, a memorial place, a bridge up at Harama. It was agreed to have a memorial to all the fallen from both sides. Well, that was the Insass Brigade that agreed, to they were supporting that. And there was Labour MPs involved as well in getting that, brought forward. But the Harama Association, they weren't. They said, no, we only want a memorial to basically to our dead, to the Republican side, not to the fascists and that. So I actually wrote to the Cardinal of Madrid, the Archbishop of Madrid, and as a Catholic, and said, in the spirit of peace and reconciliation, can a memorial be placed at Alcalá de Henares? And he wrote back and agreed.
That's good.
I've took the letters down. So I had a big International Brigade banner, flag, And the letters which have passed into the Unite branch in Waterloo. And I haven't had them back. The flag I've donated to the Unite branch, since the Unison branch in Waterloo. But I left the letters there with Glenn, the secretary, and I haven't got them back. But I can always request them. And in it says, agreed a peace reconciliation. But he didn't have the jurisdiction because it now come under a different bishop for Alcalá de Henares. So I wrote to him. And again, come back and said, agreed, that can be done. I sent them off to Walter Greenall, and he sent me a little buckle of first class stamps as a thank you, sort of. The memorial was then placed there by a French volunteer who survived. He went and cleared some of the land and placed a memorial there. My getting the Archbishop of Madrid and the Cardinal of Alcalá de Henares to actually agree that it should be done was not in any way didn't influence it, because it was already going to be done anyway. It was already, the memorial was only going to be placed there anyway. That was already agreed. It was just nice to have at least played a small part in that. I cover that, and of course, you know, holiday in Spain now, you see now, to talk to people in Spain, we've got lots of friends in Spain, and they're now still been digging up the bodies, and the fascist memorials are all coming down, even, you know, Franco's memorial now, he's been took out of there, you know, and the slaughter that Franco did. And but they're still digging bodies up, and, you know, like the other year, the Malaga Airport extension, they dug up loads of bodies there, hang, you know, tied behind the back and, you know, yeah, executed.
I mean, it is, as you say, it's getting better over there, but there's still a lot of, like, pro-Franco feeling with the culture wars. And, yeah, again, it's the international perspective. You had unemployed people in Liverpool going to fight for a republic. You're talking about democracy in the workplace and being blacklisted. We're talking about people saying, oh, let's put memorials to the fascist dead alongside the Republican Democratic dead. And in many ways, you might go, well, that's not equal, is it? Look at what's happening now with people like Musk.
Yeah.
Doing fascist salutes, saying that the AfD is the only party that can save Germany. These are very, very modern issues as well, aren't they? And I think it's really important.
Well, on the International Brigade, and I'm just scrolling down because I actually cover the volunteers from my ward who were mentioning here that fought in Spain, three of whom actually died, lost their lives, and there's nothing. I only found this out through doing research and writing this book. I wish I'd have known it when I was a counsellor, because I would have made sure that there was something done. I mean, I did manage to do a few things I'll touch on in a minute, but one of the, as it got to his NAS brigade, it's sad that there's no local recognition. The men from this war that actually died fighting against fascism.
Another great Ken Loach film, Land and Freedom,
yeah,
about the Scouse fellow who goes to die to fight in the Civil War. But that's a great, great film about that, those times.
So the volunteers I travelled from my own ward, you had Percy Keegan from Fairhill Road, Harold Dwyer from Marmion Avenue, and Albert McCabe from Gardner Avenue.
You're joking. Yeah. I mean, that's just someone from Gardner Avenue, Marmion, yeah, where my friend lives, and Fairhill.
Yeah.
Died in the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah. Albert Cave from Gardner Avenue was killed at Brunet. And there's nothing sort of... You look back to sort of, you know, Jack Jones, he wrote a letter from Barcelona in 1938 regarding Britain and France's reluctance to support the democratically elected government. And he says, we believe there can be no compromise between fascism and the democratic ideas for which we ourselves have come here to fight. 40 months later, the world's at war.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, you know, so you've got three people from this ward, and, you know, that. And I was telling Ralph about Albert McCabe. If I'd have known when I was a councillor, I'd have, you know, he used to have a blue plaque on his door.
Well, I'll tell you what, do you want to make a commitment, me and you, to try and do something about that?
Yeah.
Because I think that needs to be remembered.
Well, there's three, Percy Keegan, Harold Dwyer and Albert McCabe.
Yeah. Maybe we could get a few people together, maybe listening to this, to look to kind of remedy that. Maybe.
Yeah, I think sort of. It's like also when you look at the Blitz in Bootle, and there was a firefighter from Garden Avenue who was killed in the Blitz. Again, you know, it's when you look at the Bootle War dead in the Blitz, and there's a, you know, a firefighter was killed at Rimrose Road. He lived in Gardner Avenue, and this is just round the corner. One of the things I did, which I'm really proud of, was as a councillor, it struck me that there was nothing to commemorate the civilian loss of lives in Bootle during the Blitz. So I was talking to Bryn Marsh, who was the education director, and he had a book done called Bootle and the Blitz, and he gave me a copy of it, and it was really nice that he put in, he says, I've got the book there, he says, to Bobby Brennan, a real Bootle mayor, which is really nice. And I said to him, I said, there's a picture of this clock that was in Bedford Road School on the wall, and it stopped as the incendiary bombs fell through the classroom roof. And I said, wouldn't it be great if that clock was still around? He said, it's down in the basement. So we had to took out the basement, and it now stands in the foyer in the Bootle Town Hall with a plaque underneath it that says, this was placed here by Councillor Robert Brennan in commemoration of the civilians who lost their lives in the Bootle Town in the Bootle Blitz.
I think I might have mentioned this before. In the official history of the war, Bootle's mentioned once. It says it got heavy bombing, but it actually was bombed more than any other area of the UK.
Yeah, most bombed provincial town outside of London. But a clock there now, the clock's on the wall, the actual clock, and there's a picture underneath it of the clock on the wall in the Blitz, you know, in the school with the incendiary bombs. And that to me is a fit memorial, because Ralph says when he goes in, he says to people, oh, that's, you know, Bobby had that put there, and which it did, which is, you know, that's, if one thing as a counter, that's probably the most proudest things that I did, you know, as a counter. And again, I touch on when it was mayor of Sefton, and I mean, I went to Gdansk, lay the wreath at the joint wreath at the West of Platte Memorial, because the 60th anniversary of the open shot, the Second World War. I laid the wreath at the Solidarnosc Memorial in Gdansk, and it was the support of Solidarnosc. And then,
so they were the trade union movement that was opposed to the Polish communist Soviet kind of government domination, weren't they?
And the mayor of Gdansk at the time, Pavel Adamowicz, he was great, but he was fatally stabbed in 2019 while watching the finale of a Polish charity. So I cover that in the book, and then I went to Fort Lauderdale, you know, with the twinning agreement with Sefton Council, and the mayor then was a guy called Jim Nogle, and he was the longest serving mayor in the history of Fort Lauderdale. He was a Democrat, but regularly supported the
Republicans. Just tell people the history of Fort Lauderdale in the United States, yeah? Just tell people what the significance is of that.
Yeah, well, Sefton Council used to have many twinning arrangements. They always had, Southport was always twinned with Gdansk because of the Gdansk fire.
Yeah.
And that twinning was arranged. It was there before Sefton becomes Sefton in 1974. And Bult was always twinning with Mons. Well, those twinning arrangements continue. But
Mons is in Belgium, isn't it? Big battle.
But they decided to twin with, like, Paphos in Cyprus. Yeah. And before that, Fort Lauderdale. It was about, you go over there to, you know, talk about regeneration, and obviously we have all the golf over here, and you know, the Royal Birkdale. It was all about that, but in the end it was just, you know, junkets. That's what it was. It was a piss up an account, you know, and you know, a few days away, and it didn't really amount on. So they no longer twin with them, and they just kept the ones Mons and Southport. Yeah. But I went across for the twinning with Fort Lauderdale. It was over about 4 days. It was unbelievable because, you know, I arrived at Newark Airport, and I was, everyone else had gone through another queue, and I was stuck behind a woman from Puerto Rico who was illegally trying to enter the USA. So I was held up for about, you know, 40 minutes, and then the guy at the passport control says to me, purpose of your visit? And I said, well, civic, you know, and mayor. And he went, where's your bodyguards? Don't have any, you know. And then he told me he's going to Fort Lauderdale, and he said to me, oh, his brother-in-law was the captain of the police in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, right.
And it was all bizarre, but when we went to Fort Lauderdale, I mean, he was the mayor, Jim Nogle, he was the longest-serving mayor in history of Florida. He was a Democrat, but regularly voted with the Republicans. And the LGBTQ plus community hates him because he was very anti-sort of, you know, and anti-gay. One of the chief exec, fought with the American Marines in Vietnam, and he had all these, like, pictures in his room of, like, you know, Viet Cong prisoners and things like that. It was just... And he'd be asked, like, do you know Mrs. Lawrence from York and things like that?
I've had that before.
You know, no, I don't.
How did you come up with the title? What's the significance of the title then?
It was actually local politics and how it can be malicious.
So what's it called again? Just
a glittering malice.
Glittering malice. Yeah, you're talking about the good things about it, but also the negative.
And I cover that in here because, I mean, as a councillor, I come across things where the councillors were being deselected. There were things which amounted to not but a kangaroo court. Mm. There was and also there was an attempt to prevent me from being a councillor, a really serious attempt to, you know, a character assassination on me when I was first selected. But fortunately, because it involved the trade union movement and the unemployed centres, we had a barrister from Brabant Holden Solicitors. Mm. A barrister was appointed and wiped the floor with the local Labour Party. And it's all in the book about, you know, I'd allegedly sort of informed a woman to the Social Security rank. I said, this is Councillor Bobby Brennan, this woman's working on the side, and this, that and the other. Well, I wasn't a councillor. You know, I was a candidate.
Yeah.
I wasn't a councillor. Well, in fact, I wasn't even a candidate. It was a Labour nomination. I hadn't even got to the candidate stage. And it was like, all of a sudden, this one's been blown up. And we found out who it was. I don't mention who it was in the book, but I know it was because a senior Labour councillor told me he was responsible. And then the DWP had to meet with the Labour group, and they said, we've never even met this person. This was, someone rang up anonymously, and someone in our office acted on it. And then it was like, well, did you not check? Was the councillor said, no, when someone rings up, said, I'm councillor so-and-so. So it all came out in regards to, it was a character assassination. Yeah. But that was just one thing, and then that's, there was something which is a lot more concerning about me. They were opening a one-stop shop in Bootle.
And this is a council place that you drop into.
Yeah, and there was three trade unionists were sacked from the one-stop shop because they were supposed of like abused council officers. Well, I was contacted because I was as a trade unionist, I was the secretary of the South Devon Trades Council at the time, and he said even the police didn't see anything, and police officers actually said, gave a statement, no, there was nothing happened there, we didn't see anything. So I went to a Labour group meeting, and I said, it was being discussed about whether they support these trade unions, and it was agreed that they should uphold the council decision to sack them. And I said, you can't sack them. I said, what have they done? I said, there's no evidence. I said, because even the police, I said, look, I've got statements saying the police hadn't even saw this incident. But what they said is, oh, well, no, the mayor's seen it. The mayor's given a statement that he heard it. Well, the mayor that heard it was then sent to prison for fraud. You know, so the same person who allegedly heard what these, you know, this abuse, which there wasn't any, you know, I mean, the police didn't hear nothing. There was no other witness apart from the mayor. And it was just that they wanted to get rid of these trade unions, and they did. They determined to get rid of them by hook or by crook, and they did. So that was disgusting. And there was another occasion where a Labour councillor who was on the planning committee was allegedly leaked some planning details out to Liverpool Echo, and he decided it was a specific councillor who's a really good friend of mine. He was seen as a bit of a pain in the backside to Labour Grave because he was always questioning things about asking, you know, quite legitimate questions and that. He decided that they were going to suspend him, so therefore he couldn't be on the panel, and they're going to suspend him because he was the one that leaked the information. And the evidence that he had as well, it was someone with a Liverpool accent. A deep Liverpool accent, and that was the only evidence. So they had a meeting in the town hall on the Sunday morning, and I went down there, and again, you know, we had a group of us. We had like two caucuses. Well, when you go down there, and you know, you and maybe one or two others, are the only ones that turn up out of, you know, what should have been about 14 members. All the others, I can only describe the words that they basically, you know, they sit out. They weren't going to get involved. And I went down there, and I was working legal profession. I turned around and I said to the chief whip at the time, this is a kangaroo court. This wouldn't stand up in a court of law. This is disgraceful. And anyway, they decided, you know, by about, you know, 15 votes to 2 or 15 votes to 3 to suspend them. And therefore, he could be selected as a councillor, as a candidate. But he's resigned anyway, and he put his resignation. So I've seen things like that, Tim. So when you look at sort of, you know, you're all like comrades here. Well, you're not. If your face doesn't fit, or you don't, you know, you're seen as not going to vote for that group or that, you know, you're out. Oral Mount Park, I mean, after my support for the residents of Oral Mount Park, I mean, I was reported to whip, but then it was thrown back because there was no case to answer. I hadn't broken any party rules by speaking to residents. I'd complied to the Nolan principles by keeping people informed and being transparent, but I was reported to the whip, and that was thrown back, so there's no case to answer. And then I was kept out the loop. There was things going on. I mean, there was one part with the residents. I think I said this in the last podcast where I said to the residents, I'll keep them informed when consultation starts. And then I get told it was in the Echo, the consultation, and I wasn't told. And it was like, oh, we forgot to mention it to you. So I put a complaint into the Labour Party nationally because I was getting kept out the loop. The things were going, they were beatings, and I weren't being informed about them. It went to the Labour Party's complaint, and it come back, so it doesn't meet our the criteria. So me and that the friend of mine who was still the councillor who resigned, he's still a party member. Well, we got together and he said, no, look, here's the rule book, this, that, the other. So we sent it back again. Sent it right to David Evans, the chair of the Labour Party, and said, this is this, blah, blah, blah. It meets this regulation. And we told, yeah, leave it with us, this will go straight in. Never heard a thing.
Do you know what? I've experienced some stuff in the trade union where you've got it in black and white almost. Yeah. And it just gets rejected, a complaint like that. I mean, I could talk all day about those kinds of incidents. When's the book going to be published then, or when's it going to be available?
Well, I'm opened. I was open at the end of January, but it's probably going to be sometime in February, hopefully. I mean, there's a couple of publishers I've looked at, and I'm not sure which one to go with yet, but it'll be on paperback and maybe on the Kindle. I'm not, you know, but...
Well, put me down for one anyway.
Yeah, so. It's February. But just briefly, before I mentioned about being the mayor, and I said about Formby, went to a function in Ainsdale. They were doing the crown of the Rose Queen. God's honest truth, what happened. On arrival, we met by a rather frantic... This was in the book. On the arrival, we were met by a rather frantic woman. Mr. Mayor, you were late. We're about to crown the Rose Queen. We had two of our youngest children with us, aged 11 and 9, and this woman said they would not have to wait here with the defendant. They can't follow the with the procession. So my wife, who was Mayor Esther, responded, well, if they're not allowed the procession, then neither will we be taking part. So this woman stood there, mouth wide, look of shock, and then said, oh, well, hurry up then. There was a large marquee that had plants for sale inside. And as I was walking over, the same woman said to me, there's nothing in there that would be interesting to you, Mr. Mayor. When I said I like flowers, she said, do you have a garden, Bootle? And when Leslie was looking at a collage, another person said to her, don't you think they're lovely? They were done by the local schools. Leslie said, yes, my daughter's done them in school. To be asked, did they do them in Bootle schools? Leslie replied, well, of course, they are all Sefton schools. And then also, going back to religion, I was asked by the civic service officer that the mayor always waves off the Orange Lodge from some little library, with the site of the old little library, and I was asked if I would like the deputy mayor to do it with me being a Catholic, as apparently a former Catholic mayor declined and asked the deputy to do it. I was taken back and said, well, why would they not want to do it? Because he waved off the Orange Lodge.
That's great.
You know, but it was sort of, you know, would you want the deputy to do it? Because, and as a former Labour mayor, had.
You must have some story. I know you've recited a few there, but it's those little things. And I think when I worked in trade unions and in schools as a union rep, some of the stuff I saw, and the stories you're talking about there in like local politics, I mean, it's a damning like situation, isn't it? You know,
well, I mean, obviously, I covered it as corporal punishment of being, you know, and as a child being, you know, my dad would think nothing of punching me in front of my mates, things like that. His father was a bully by all accounts and developed psychosis and ended up in Ward 30 and Fazakerley Hospital, as it was then. One time we would go there. They lived in Grieve Road, Fazakerley, which is quite, you know, an appropriate name because it was a house of really, you know, of sadness. You'd walk in and the first thing that greeted you was a big, you know, plaque on the wall, or a big, like, a memorial to Abel Stephen John Brennan, who was drowned in 1959 off the, you know, on it was on HMS Cossack. That was my uncle. And I thought it was commissioned by, it was there, put there by the Admiralty, but it wasn't. It was commissioned by my uncle, me gran and granddad on my dad's side, his mum and dad, commissioned it off my uncle, who had, you know, was an artist. But that was the first time I greeted it. It was like quite somber, you know, you've seen that. You go in there, and the same as in a home, all you'd have on was grants and the horse racing. So you go there and you'd sat there. And it was one time, there was me and my sister were there, and in the book it says I got fed up with just stroking Mick the cat in the end, and my granddad's trilby, was Sunday Best, was on the mantelpiece at the side, and I put it on and pudged it. It then looked like a bowl hat rather than a trilby. Well, he come out and he was saying to me, you know, he was bastard this and bastard that, and he threw me in the back garden it's called the Green Shed, and I dedicated chapter two, though it's not really deserving of a chapter, a few pages. And I was thrown in there, must have been about 11 o'clock. My dad had gone out with his brother to the Copple House. And I was in there, and it was dark before he came back, and I could still smell. The only thing that was keeping that shed together was the roof. And there was an old lawnmower in there. You could smell old paint cans. And I saw the light come on in the back room, in the backyard. And, you know, my dad opened the padlock, well, the lock, and it came out, And all his dad, my granddad, was saying, you know, you're not to go thrash and things like that. And the day when I got home, I was, you know, my dad used to have a belt, a black, thick leather belt, which was kept upstairs. And it was, you know, go and get my belt. It was that, you know, just descending the stairs to get that, you know, to get the belt. And then, so yeah, there was lots. And again, you know, as a child, I mean, I didn't get on with my father. He started off the trade union movement. I didn't know him as a child because he was in the Merchant Navy. So I grew up with my granddad, and when I did get, you know, my dad, he was a trade union steward. Then he went across to the other side, you know, become a personal officer. And there's things in the, you know, in the book where people will be quite a lot of shock, and you know what went on. And but you have to tell it warts and all. Like it's no good saying. And I didn't speak to my dad didn't bother with him from when I was about 18. Well, probably a year before that, 15. I didn't like him because of what was going on, the way he was. So I'd say probably about like 14, 15 up till I was 28. And then it was only later on in life that when he became unwell and he lost his job in personnel, he ended up as a security guard in the Ardale Centre and as a carer in a home. And it took Tolan being that, you know, high flyer to suddenly being, you know, not having the money and all that. And then I helped him with, like, applications for what was called disability living allowance and got him benefits. And it was only, you know, in later life, when he was probably my age, that I really got to know him. And then I used to look forward to going to meet him once a week. I'd meet him in the Halton Castle in Ormskirk. But then he still hadn't changed. He still had his, you know, his mannerisms, his sarcasm. You know, he'd still put you down. And he'd done that even when it was Mayor of Sefton. There was a book that everyone, there was a piece of paper in the mayor's parlour, everyone was signing, saying, oh, well done, Bobby, this, that, and the other. And my dad wrote on it, remember, I did it first my way. You know, I mean, my parents both passed away. They're not there to defend themselves, but what is in this book is true. Yeah. And you can't leave out things because it forms you growing up. It's all part of how I was.
Yeah.
Probably becoming the mod, rebelling against them. My friends, you know, sort of, you know, were very supportive of me and things like that. And then even in school, the school knew the problems that was going at home. They even invited my parents to come down. He wouldn't come to school because it was impacting on me. You're 12 years of age and your dad says to you, yeah, right, you're the man of the house now and I'm taking myself off. Things like that, you know, it leaves, doesn't just sort of, it's something you just can't shake off. And then the school teacher would say to me, look, you know, you get involved in sports, tradition. And they encouraged me in the school, you know, to do what I did. And I love school. And then I'd say, I dedicate the book to all the things that I remember, the good things, the funny things, the holidays in the Isle of Man with my granddad, and the people that have been fortunate to know. I mean, we could have gone to live in Berkshire with the atomic, you know, when it was down the atomic weapons establishment, but it was a struggle going down there to, you know, Basingstoke from a Friday night, leaving at 6 o'clock, getting to Lime Street at 12, having to go back on a Sunday morning, and then decided not to go. Then we could have got, we were offered work in the Isle of Man. But all things, I think your life's mapped out, and I think I covered all that, you know, and even the poverty where we had paraffin heaters, even as an apprentice, we couldn't afford heating, so we had paraffin heaters. If they'd gone to down the southeast, if they'd gone to the Isle of Man, I wouldn't have met the wonderful people that I have.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the opportunities would have opened up for me, like getting involved in legal profession, and that was through a council officer, Brian Gibson. I was doing welfare rights cases against the council. Brian Gibson spoke to a solicitor, Keith Park, and said, well, our councillors is brilliant at welfare, you know, for rights and debt. And I ended up in the legal profession working for Keith Park solicitors, and then, you know, with Ken and Benjamin case solicitors. And they were the most supportive employers, probably, when I was mayor. They supported the whole year. And, of course, from then I gained interest in mental health when I was at them, you know, the mental health lord and stuff. And my life has been, wouldn't have been as so fulfilling if it had gone to the Isle of Man or if it had gone to the South East. So I'm grateful for all that. And I just want to get it all down in writing.
I think that's a good place to finish it, because I think I was listening to a podcast this morning and people talking about, if you lived your life again, would you change it? And you go, well, no, because it doesn't matter what you've been through, that forms you. And maybe you view it differently as you get older, when you become wiser, but it's all part of what makes us human. But yeah. I really look forward to reading the book, Bobby.
Yeah, and, just finally, to me, in regards to being outside of politics, I mean, since I left the Labour Party, I mean, it's like October 2022, I've not missed it. Yeah. I've not missed it at all. The sad thing about it, there's only one, probably, Labour councillor, Sue Bradshaw, who was a ward colleague, who's kept in touch with me since I've left. There's only Sue that's inquired, you know, about, you know, how I am, how's the family doing, which is pretty poor. But that's something I found out, you know, once someone leaves politics, they're not really, they're no longer, you know, yeah, you know, seen as someone to associate with. But I've not missed it. I'm enjoying, I'm able to carry on and work. I didn't have to retire, carry on and work, and I love the work that I do. I'm delivering lots of more training, and CVS is great, the work I'm doing with CVS, and I've got
Community and Voluntary Service with Sefton.
Yeah, yeah, so I really enjoy that. So I didn't have to retire, I don't know how you can do both jobs. I can work full time and do a counsellor's job. It was a struggle, yeah, particularly in the legal profession. But I don't miss it. But what I do fear is the rise in right-wing populism.
Yeah.
I think that, because I think I have to say now, if I hadn't left the Labour Party when I did, I probably would have resigned over the cuts to, you know, the winter fuel allowance, broken promises to students, loans, even the with this happening in the farming industry. I think we've lost an opportunity, and I think in 4 or 5 years' time, I think we're going to see, you know, a right wing populist, you know, government, possibly Farage, and I fear for the future. You know, Trump now back in America, the impact that's going to have on global politics, And I just think we've lost an opportunity to, you know, to look after the most vulnerable. And I think that the Labour Party will not be forgiven for what they've done.
I think, again, that's another good theme to acknowledge. And for me, the rise of the right and the populist right is a huge, huge issue at the moment. Yeah. Bobby, thank you very much for your time and good luck with the book, and Put Me Down for it. And it's a very important thing to get out there. Cheers, mate.
Great. Okay.